Well, without more ado, I mean, everybody knows Professor O'Connell now, and this is the third in the series of talks on... Well, the first one wasn't so much, but this is a follow-up from last week's talk on the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And the Krishnadasa Kaviraja's Chaitanya Charitamrita, its values as a witness to historical events. So it sounds very interesting.
Okay, ready to roll?
Yeah, ready to roll.
Very good. Welcome back. Thank you all for coming. We'll be taking a very different approach to the Chaitanya Charitamrita in this session, though it assumes the significance of the previous inquiry into the Chaitanya Charitamrita as a religious literary work deeply permeated by symbolism, intended to evoke and shape the devotional imagination of the audience. We assume that it's that kind of text. What can we learn if you approach it from a different angle? That being the case, one may ask, and it has been asked more or less responded to in different ways, but hardly in any definitive way, and today's attempt will be in no way definitive either. What, if any, value does such an inclusive and influential text as the Chaitanya Charitamrita have as a witness to people and events and the prevailing socio-cultural patterns of its time, of composition, or of the time that it purports to report on? At the mundane level of human history? A fair question. Some of you whose emails I have at hand, have received a couple of papers by me related to today's topic. I intend, with apologies to those if you've already read them, to repeat some excerpts from them, as they represent the gist of what I have to say. If any of you did not receive these but would like to get them or other pieces related to any of my Shiv Dasani, and they're the sponsor of my visit here, Shiv Dasani seminars and lectures, just leave with me at the end of the session your email address and I'll be happy to send them along. Okay? And don't hesitate to break in now and again, especially if you find the dulcet monotony of my voice getting to you. What doesn't get said doesn't get said, but what gets said should be duly accessible while you're still wide awake and listening on a Friday afternoon. Okay, there will be three foci of today's session on appreciating and maximizing the value of the Chaitanya Charitamrita as a witness to its contemporary and prior human history. The first is a general reappraisal of sacred biographies of Krishna Chaitanya as potential sources for reliable historical information. This reappraisal is shaped as a rebuttal to an all too widely shared view that the religious or mythic intentionality and character of such texts simply overwhelms their reliability as witnesses to history, even the history of the devotional community of Vaishnavas, which they purport to report. The late Professor Edward C. Dimmock Jr. and Amulya Chandra Sen well represent this view, though motivated, I think, by quite different concerns. The second part will address a claim, again widely shared by Professor Dimmock in particular, for whom, by the way, I have the highest professional respect and personal respect and friendship for many years. Again, it's a claim widely shared by him in particular that several of Chaitanya's closest associates and a number of the latter's immediate disciples were sahajiyas, that is, practitioners of a Vaishnavite version of socio-culturally transgressive left-handed tantra variety. Here, I argue, correctly or not, that none of the score or more individuals identified by Professor Dimmock can be clearly or even probably shown on the basis of the textual and biographic evidence to be of Sahajiya orientation. On this issue, the evidence of the Chaitanya Charitamrita itself is crucial, especially with reference to one Ramananda Rai, an intimate associate of Krishna Chaitanya. On the other hand, however, it was ironically the appearance of the Chaitanya Charitamrita early in the 17th century that made accessible in vernacular Bangla language the imaginative symbolism and theological terminology that enabled left-handed tantrics in Bengal to craft a veneer of Vaishnava symbolism and theological terminology. A parallel process, we should note, had been done by Sahajiya-type practitioners in Bengal for centuries, using Buddhist, Shakta, Shaiva, and even some Sufi Muslim symbolism and terminology. one of the main processes analyzed in great detail by Tony K. Stewart in his important book, on the Chaitanya Charitamritam, The Final Word, one of the main processes that he shows is the way that the Sahajiya advocates within the wider Chaitanya Vaishnava community manage to exploit what he calls windows of opportunity, to craft and legitimate, to their own satisfaction at least, a Vaishnava version of Sahajiya. The 17th century Sahajiyas among Vaishnavas seized upon such things as the androgynous conception of Chaitanya as Krishna cum Radhar in one body, plus the imaginative symbolism of passionate love, technical theology, and mentions of intimately secret or esoteric devotion that don't get spelled out in that Chaitanya Charitamritam, which allows the Sahajiyas and others to say, this is the secret esoteric teaching that now we bring forward for you. Something we find again and again in the Buddhist tradition, but and elsewhere as well. This way, they explicitly denied nothing there that was previously central to Chaitanya Vaishnava tradition. They acknowledged the Chaitanya Charitamritam and the other texts, while claiming to make explicit a type of male-female yogic practice not found in any of the preceding Sanskrit or Bangla texts respected by Chaitanya Vaishnavas. The third part of today's seminar, and I probably shouldn't try to put too many things into one, but I'm only here for one term. The third part of today's seminar is a glimpse at the glimpses given by the Chaitanya Charitamritam and other Chaitanya Vaishnava sacred biographies and later hagiographies at a vastly wider phenomenon, namely the prevailing sense of being in some sense Hindu as the binary alternative to the sector of the population they called Javan, Yavana, or Mlecha, what we would more likely call Muslim. Finally, there should be some concluding remarks, some guidelines or rules of thumb, either along the way or at the end, for appreciating and maximizing the value of the Chaitanya Charitamritam and other Vaishnava sacred biographies and later hagiographies as witnesses to contemporary or prior history. If I were Northrop Frye, of course, I would not start until someone said something, but I don't have quite his discipline, nor have I his eminence. Number one, then, the basic argument, what I called in the article Historicity in the Biographies of Chaitanya, which is found in Journal of Vaishnava Studies quite a ways back, 1992-93 winter, Myth in Quest of History. I write of myth as being, quote, in quest of history, although history in quest of myth might serve just as well, as these two dimensions or perspectives of Chaitanya Vaishnava devotional faith are fundamentally integrated and mutually dependent, and in some respects, I think, reinforcing. I do so to highlight what I think is demonstrably the case, that the biographers of Chaitanya were motivated to record many empirical details of the life and times of Chaitanya precisely because they saw him through the eyes of a distinctive kind of faith. That distinctive kind of faith is Krishna Bhakti, devotion in the form of loving service to the divine Krishna, or Krishna Kumrata, as manifested in Chaitanya. This kind of faith puts a positive valuation on certain specific features of personalities, human and or superhuman, and their activities, including selected details of time, place, and perceptible appearance. I stress this point as a corrective to a differing view to be discussed below, that has gained currency. That view would contend that due to the biographer's commitment to Krishna Bhakti, they were so preoccupied with archetypal symbols, theological categories, and narrative patterns, largely from the Srimad Bhagavatam, that is, the mythic or transcendent Krishna, that their concern for the historical details of Chaitanya's life was virtually dissolved or overwhelmed. It is, of course, not the case that the one senior or several junior contemporaries of Chaitanya who recorded his life and work intended to write unabridged, critical, commitment-free chronicles. They were not professional academics, but engaged devotees. Nor was their kind of religious faith quite the same as the God who acts in history type thought to be articulated in the Judeo-Christian Bible, though the convergences may be closer than one might think. Anyway, moreover, what contemporary history they did record was obviously selective. They eliminated some and stressed other data, They also added on to the historical in the sense of weaving into their accounts of 15th, 16th century events, descriptions of timeless mythic happenings, transcendent heavenly realms, divine descents upon the earth, and the like. This is all quite evident. But what is also evident, or so it seems to me, is that there lies preserved in the midst of these so-called mythic factors, both despite them and in some respects because of them, a wealth of historically reliable information on Chaitanya, on his contemporaries, and on their historical milieu. It does, however, require much careful and patient comparing, sifting, analyzing, and interpreting of the several accounts, and a good knowledge of much wider Vaishnava literature and theology if one is to isolate the empirical historical elements held in suspension, as it were, within the encompassing religious ambience of Chaitanya's biographies. Okay, that is directly from an earlier article that some of you have received. Chaitanya devotees understood this appearance of Hari or Krishna in human form to be a lila, a manifest lila, a divine sport, the core participants of which were Chaitanya and his contemporary associates. We talked a lot about lila in the last session. But if Hari, if God, had chosen to manifest a modality of himself as Narahari, as God in human form, then the faithful devotee has an obligation to pay heed, to pay attention, and to proclaim to others faithfully the words and even the bodily appearance of Chaitanya and his devoted associates. Chaitanya being Narahari, and they, by a certain theology, also in part divine. To do otherwise would be ungrateful and obtuse, reckless of one's chances for salvation, if you didn't pay attention to the peculiarities of that particular lila manifestation. Such a manifestation of divine lila is, in the eye of devout Vaishnava faith, a rare and wonderful act of divine graciousness. Devotees born too late to view Chaitanya with their own eyes lamented their ill fate, but at least they could take some consolation from savoring the tales of Chaitanya's acts, sweet as nectar of immortality. Okay. Some comments on that second excerpt. There is, of course, no good reason to think that Krishna Das strove for strict fidelity to the empirical layer of his compositions, perhaps because he himself was shrewd enough to realize that over nearly a century later, it would be extremely difficult to get a verbatim photographed report of what Chaitanya or his associates did and said. But where there were reasonably plausible accounts of Chaitanya's and his associates and their activities, especially if reported by early writers and repeated more or less consistently by later ones, we may assume that he would utilize these accounts more or less as handed down to him, though he might tweak them somewhat to serve his homiletic didactic purposes. In view of his main audience's familiarity with prior detailed accounts of Chaitanya and his associates, it would complicate and undermine the task, his task to deviate too far and too often from the received tradition. And Tony Stewart is very, very good in showing how carefully Krishna Das managed to bring in earlier accounts, though indeed with a good deal of what I've called tweaking, and he might see it as a bit more intentional deviation than that. So hence, one rule of thumb, when the Chaitanya Charitamritam follows the prior tradition closely, the empirical layer of his compounded composition is likely to be quite faithful to the historical phenomena as they occurred. Stewart repeatedly observes that the Krishna Das Kaviraj prefers not to openly disagree with his predecessor, sacred biographers, for the political purpose of drawing the respective sectors of the Chaitanya Vaishnava community into a more inclusive community, integrated through the overarching system of devotional thought, practice, and experience developed in Vrindavan. But the same tendency may also be accounted for by a desire not to lose credibility by deviating too far from what the community already held to be true. Whatever the political or rhetorical, that is, persuasive strategy of Krishna Das Kaviraj, the result would seem to be constraint against departing too far from established accounts of the myriad events reported from the time of Chaitanya and his contemporaries. Another rule of thumb for reading Krishna Das's Chaitanya Charitamritam is to realize that in his effort to incorporate prior accounts, but in a cohering, plausible fashion, he is likely to eliminate some of the more fanciful, exaggerated, or polemic versions of a phenomenon. But the version he ends up with is not likely to be verbatim, but rather a roughly faithful gist of what was said and done. In a way, Krishnadas Kaviraj himself was doing something akin to what the modern historian finds him or herself doing, reading and comparing as many relevant accounts as possible, and then deriving the most plausible, rough approximation of what occurred. A further rule of thumb, and this is really a rule of thumb, is what I call the dot matrix comic book effect. If you ever bother to take a good magnifying glass or a poor quality microscope on an old-fashioned comic book, you discover that all you have are these little blue and green and red dots and whatnot. The closer you get, the less you see of anything. If you stand back a bit, the less you see of the dots, the more it turns out to be Superman, or whatever it happens to be. So the dot matrix... comic book effect helps explain how from looking at not just multiple versions of the same event, but at many of the remembered events, one may come up with more meaningful patterns of phenomena that would appear from even verbatim accounts of an isolated phenomenon. So here I should mention what I haven't already, that if you are to at all maximize what you learn from reading the Chaitanya-charitamrita, you should be reading the other text as well, and you should be reading what it says and what they say of the other events. Each event is going to be an approximation, but if you get enough events that are somewhat approximated, a certain pattern begins to appear, and if you're a good Levi Straussian, all you really want are the patterns anyway, but we don't have to go that far where everything becomes binary opposites. But I do think that you can get a good sense of much of what's going on in that community at that time looking as closely as you can and then pulling back and then getting the pattern that emerges as you begin to pull back. A further rule of thumb, the inherent constraints of Leela. Leela is what is supposed to open up the imagination, but Chaitanya-like or Krishna-like, Chaitanya-leela or Krishna-leela as a whole must remain dominantly human, or at least in the appearance of dominantly human, and dominantly in the Madhurya mode. If you are to be in the 10th book of the Bhagavata Purana, or you're to be in the Chaitanyaite Vaishnava world of meaning, all of the events of Chaitanya's life in some way are constrained, that you do want to stress the human-like. He said not to have a physical body, but it looks like a physical body, and it does all the things it weeps and it gets injured as a body does. Furthermore, according to the Leela understanding of the Chaitanyaites, the Leela is an example for human devotion. And therefore, what you describe of Chaitanya should be something that would be human enough-like, for one to actually follow it. They considered a uniquely remarkable saintly human person, so uniquely significant that fidelity to what he really was like would remain a concern, one of many concerns that would tend to constrain how far one would depart, even in the more theologically imaginative accounts of why what he did was significant. In some ways, reading the Chaitanya-charitamritam and then the others along with it is something like an historical novel, which is apt to convey the feelings and overall dynamics of past events, even if the names and other specifics are changed. But it doesn't go that far. I think there is a fair amount of the empirical data coming through. Okay, well, let's look at Ramananda Rai, the second point here. We look at one issue from within the community. What the Chaitanya-charitamritam and the other biographies, the sacred biographies, tell us is a great deal about what's going on within the Vaishnava community, and relatively little on anything outside, though they do say some interesting things at a time when no one else is saying much of anything, which is considerable. Okay, Ramananda Rai. His sadhana and the recognition of Chaitanya's divine androgyny in relationship to Sajya. One of the most important of Chaitanya's associates, alleged to be a Sahajiya by Professor Dimmock, was Ramananda Rai, a man whose devotion was deeply imbued with the amorous leelas of Krishna and Radha. Ramananda Rai is reported by Krishnadas to have practiced a particular discipline, characterized by some as sahajiyar, not known to have been followed by other mainline Chaitanya Vaishnavas. Now, Ramananda, a shooter of current caste, was influential at the court of Prataparudra and was said to have been recommended to Chaitanya by the eminent scholar and court pundit Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya because of his advanced prema bhakti or loving devotion. Ramananda himself was an accomplished Sanskritist with a Vaishnava drama, the Jagannatha Vallabhanaticum, to his credit, and very likely a producer, director of drama and dance as well. He is reported to have taught one Devadasi, a girl or a young woman dedicated to temple service, to dance before Jagannatha, and another to portray the various nuances of Bhakti Rasa Shastra, teachings on devotional aesthetics. Thus far, Ramananda's actions need not raise eyebrows, being the application of his literary and dance drama talents to the routine of devotional rituals, including dances for Jagannatha in or about the temple at Puri. Ramananda, in addition, personally served with his own hands, anointed, bathed, and rubbed the Devadasis, dressed them, and decorated all their limbs, it is reported. All the while, it is reported, he felt no more sexually aroused than if he were handling a log. As related by Krishnadasa, this behavior was part of his own sadhana, or spiritual exercise. Now, Dimmick points out that serving the parakya, that is, the girl belonging to another, not one's own wife, the parakya girl or woman, is part of the sahajiyar discipline, and at certain stages in the sahajiyar sadhana, learning to live in her presence without being aroused sexually is encouraged. Gaining sensitivity for woman's feeling by living intimately with her is also appropriate for sahajiyar. Such evidence as this, Dimmick judges that Ramananda, quote, it seems, must be considered a sahajiyar. But was he? In what sense could the term apply to him? There is no indication whatsoever that in his sadhana he conceived of himself as Krishna, or as combining both Krishna and Radha within himself, as would be standard sahajiyar doctrine. There is no indication that he reenacted with the Devadasis the archetypal union of Krishna and Radha, or of Krishna with other gopis. Quite the contrary, his own service of the Devadasis, whom he had trained to impersonate gopis, was completely devoid of masculine interest in them, whether in a spiritualized or physical mode. Quite the contrary, the role of the abhimana that he imagined or assumed in his sadhana was feminine, to serve the Devadasi as a female servant friend, a sakhi, or a young maid servant, a manjari, as she would serve the gopis. Ramananda, by aptitude and avocation, if not by profession, a man of dance and drama, apparently was exploiting the opportunities provided by instructing in dance and drama to act out and refine the feelings of his own spiritual persona, that of a devoted female servant of Radha and Krishna and their gopi associates in their amorous leelas. Ramananda Rai, then, rather than conceiving of himself as Krishna and the Devadasis as Radha, as a Vaishnava Sahajiyar would do, was carrying out the sort of feminine service to Radha and or her friends, and through them to Krishna, that typical Chaitanya Vaishnava recluses and some laypersons with advanced meditational sadhana would aspire to do through what is called Raganaga Sadhana Bhakti. In this type of devout meditation, the devotee visualizes himself, typically in the form of a girl, a manjari, about the age of puberty, as following anuga, as that is learning by assisting and imitating, a transcendent cowherdist gopi. The gopi, whom the Raganaga devotee follows in meditation, is conceived of as a special friend or sakhi of Radha, one whose passion or raga it is to serve Radha and Krishna most lovingly. The technical Chaitanya Vaishnava term for such a spiritualized or visualized persona cum body is siddha deha, perfected, realized body. The peculiarity of Ramananda's sadhana, however, and the bone of contention, is that whereas standard Raganaga sadhana bhakti is effected through one's visualized siddha deha in meditation, Ramananda effected his sadhana by imagining the physically present Devadasis to be the gopis. By serving them, he, imagining himself to be their female servant, sought to perfect his own devotion for Radha and Krishna. His idiosyncratic sadhana was indeed deviant from what became normative Chaitanya Vaishnava Raganaga sadhana bhakti, but not in a sahajiyar direction, and that is the point at issue. It has also been suggested that it was Ramananda's alleged involvement in Sahajiya that enabled him to be the first to declare that Chaitanya was really Krishna and Radha combined. Or more exactly, Krishna having taken unto himself the persona or feelings, the bhava of Radha. It is not improbable that Ramananda, presumably well-read and widely connected at court, was aware of Tantra in some of its various forms, and he may well have known personally individuals of left-handed tantric leanings. Any such exposure to Tantra, with its emphasis on the binary male-female symbolism at the core of sacred and profane or macrocosmic and microcosmic reality, could well have enhanced his perceptiveness of Chaitanya as the simultaneous embodiment of Radha and Krishna. But there are other ways by which the idea of the combined presence of Radha and Krishna in the one person of Chaitanya could have suggested itself to Ramananda. There's a wealth of Puranic, Vaishnava, as well as Shaiva, Shakta symbolism, and likewise archaic Vedic Upanishad imagery of divine androgyny to which he would have been exposed. But there is a more immediate and obvious explanation for Ramananda's interpretation of Chaitanya, namely Chaitanya himself. Chaitanya, whom his disciples already were proclaiming as Krishna in human form, was manifesting, at least in the confidential presence of Ramananda, who was himself well sensitized to such feelings, precisely the bhavas, the feelings of Radha and the gopis. For Ramananda Rai to recognize and declare Chaitanya's dual incarnation hardly required that he have been a sahajiya or even subject to significant influence by them. His own devotional psychological inclinations and general exposure to Hindu religio-cultural milieu could well have sufficed. And of course, there remains that crucial difference between Ramananda's and eventually most Chaitanya Vaishnava's conviction that Chaitanya was the unique manifestation of Krishna with the persona, feelings, bhava of Radha, and the opposite, the conviction of the Vaishnava Sajjayas that any human adept may experience oneself as that divine pair. Okay, pause a bit after. Moving right along. I'll slow down the level, the speed of speech here. Okay, let's look at this other. First of all, I am moving a bit faster than last time. Any questions or comments to this point? I'm sure many. Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
It's not much. It's not so much as a question as more of a comment and
good.
And support. That's what you were
support,
saying.
Support, devastation, whatever it is. It's part of the experience.
I mean, the idea that Ramananda being a sahaja, as the argument goes, sort of helping Chaitanya to kind of bring out the sort of the dual nature of, as being Krishna and Radha, and that sort of having a sahaja dimension to it. To me, that never made much sense, because if you look at the Chaitanya Charitamrita and towards the end in his stay in Puri, when this kind of comes out in the presence of Ramananda, there's actually not much talk of him being sort of a male person at all. His emotions are all said to be Radha's emotions, mm-hmm. and that's the role he plays there. And there's very, very few episodes actually in the Antyalila where he's actually sort of having presented as playing the role of Krishna, but it's always Radha that comes out. I'm puzzled I'm as puzzled now as I was when I first read Edward Dimmock's argument regarding that of sort of pushing it in a sahaja direction. That's kind of my
My sense of the place of the hidden moon where Dimmock presents this, and which is very widely read book, and assumed it's accurate in all respects. Its strength, as I see it, is his ability to articulate what, from the point of view of the Sahajiya Vaishnava, is a coherent, in some ways even ennobling mode of left tantric piety. One of the points that he makes, and I think is, or does he make it? No, he makes it, and it strikes me as as an important Vaishnava contribution to this perennial, what I call rustic, left tantric yoga that we find in Bengal, is the in a way the humanizing it, this idea of getting to understand the feelings of the woman, appreciating the woman. Now, nowadays, there's a certain amount of talk going on, especially coming out of, I think, feminist critique stuff. How do women fare in tantric sadhana? There's most of the texts, all of them, are written by men. They are almost all from the point of view of the male. Is the woman simply an instrument in this? Does the male really care that much about the female? Well, according to Dimmock's, what we might say, his most optimistic view of how a good, pious, Madhurya-liking Chaitanyaite Vaishnava might get into sahajya would be to take the woman's feelings very seriously. But, again, as part of his seeing himself being the Madhurya-level youthful Krishna lover, which I think is... I think he got carried away in a kind of detective work in that part, in the part of the book where he says, are there sahajiyas around? And the arguments don't hold up too well. However, from the point of view of the sahajiya, some of these logical connections aren't all that important. They seize upon the fact that Ramananda was close with women, that he did see male and female and whatnot, and that's basically all they need. Tony Stewart, at the end of his book... even though he makes it pretty clear, and I'm glad that he does, that the development of the Vaishnava Sahajiya text comes after the Chaitanya Charitamritam, because that's what gave them the terminology and the scriptural basis. What he's fascinated to do is to say that for the Sahajiyas, they do something to the Chaitanya Charitamritam, as the Chaitanya Charitamritam has been able to do with some of the earlier texts, namely finding openings such as what happened in the end of Chaitanya's life. The earlier biographies don't tell us much. They're written by people who are in Bengal. So Krishna Das, based on his associates in Vrindavan who had been with Chaitanya in Puri for some time, is able to give a very detailed account, much as you have just indicated, of how Chaitanya was so passionately, agonizingly longing for Krishna. Anyway, they then take his book, and then they find things like the esoteric Chaitanya, and say, that's enough, don't say any more. Ah, we will now tell you what it is. But that's a very weak kind of argumentation to have. But a lot of more work could be done on this. Yeah.
I was just wondering, where does the term sahajya come from?
Sahaj is around all, goes way, way back. I don't have all the textual references to it, but I would think of Shashibhushan Dasgupta, obscure religious cults in Bengal, would talk about sahajya, and the Buddhist sahajya, they talk about a certain amount. Sahaj itself simply means natural, simple. Among the Sikhs, who Guru Nanak and Chaitanya were contemporaries, sahaj is the ideal state of perfect calm contemplation of the human being. The Sikh, with or without his turban there, if he is spiritually advanced, is experiencing sahaj. And I would think that through the Quran, I'm just guessing, but I'm sure, pretty sure I could find evidence if you looked through the Sant literature in North India, you would find that sahaj is a common term. And natural, well, now that can be interpreted in various ways. And Dimmock himself says that there is no standard term. But what I've done in the longer article that I've sent out to those of you whose email I have, I take his definition, this is his working definition, and we apply that to Ramananda and the others. And since he did a bit of detective work, I did a bit of detective work, and I had the great advantage of following him and trying to see where there were holes in that, and nobody has bothered to follow me to see where the holes are. Tony Stewart kindly acknowledges in a footnote somewhere that I take serious issue with this, but it's a rather ambiguous note. Takes issue with Professor Dimmock's argument on on doubtful historical grounds. But it's not clear whether the doubtful historical grounds apply to my critique or to Dimmick's statement. But he then goes on, interestingly enough, after saying that this is clearly a new thing that's being built in, he then goes on to show at some length how these folks plausibly to themselves and conceivably plausibly to some readers managed to say, well, yes, from here to here to here to here it went secretly until it came out in Krishna Das. Until you finally have us working back, and even Chaitanya is supposed to have his Parakya woman accomplice, which runs totally counter to anything that you see.
Yeah.
At what point does the term Sahajiya start getting used pejoratively as a sort of label for deviant practices?
The quick answer, I don't know, but
the
pejoratively.
The bowels?
Well, the bowels are certainly within the Sahajiya realm, and they are, interestingly enough, Rabindranath has great affection for bowels, but it's not because of the left tantric bowel sadhana, it's because of the almost Vaishnavite, sant-like devotional elements that becomes a bit... It certainly doesn't appear much in the standard Chaitanya Vaishnava literature. In their own texts, the Sahajiya ones that Tony has now gone into, one wonderful thing of Tony Stewart is he's read all sorts of this stuff and he's made very good notes of it, and he compares things back and forth, so he's very much in command of what he's doing, and it would be nice if we had a few more scholars that were willing to actually read the stuff, which is relatively easy to read. It's not in kind of Bengali that's as tough as some of the Sanskrit stuff. It could be done. But when does it become a negative term? The phenomenon becomes negative with this one anti-Sahajiya post-Krishna Das figure, Manohar Das, I think is his name, who is outraged at the way they're distorting the tradition. And he's probably typical of a lot of other people. But Chaitanya Vaishnavas being as they are tend not to get worked up and highly critical of what they don't agree with. They intend to ignore them, marginalize them, and then within their own considerable network of people say, this is how it really is. It may be your Kedarnath Dutta Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who is a key figure in the late 19th century, who says, well, these Sahajiya types are causing us a lot of embarrassment. Up until then, it would seem that the Vaishnavas were less worried. Though somewhere, if I ever get to it, I think I have a concluding statement saying that it would be very interesting to see how the tradition was developing from the perspective of the main line. But I don't know when it was first used pejoratively.
Yeah, because there's that one verse naming the 13 upper sampradayas, of which one is the Sahajiya, and that verse comes even before Bhaktivinoda Thakur. That's like by one Totaram Das Babaji in 1780s.
Very fashion. Very good. After the British got there, but I don't think the fellow in Vrindavan had much British influence on it. Good. If you could find something on that, let me know. It's a good point. Okay, well, let's move on then to the third point here. The Krishnadas Kaviraj and the Chaitanya Charitamritam in relation to the meaning of Hindu and the perception of Muslims by Vaishnavas in the 16th and early 17th century Bengal. Okay. This is sort of my own quick, where I was in my biography when I did this study way back at the thesis time, the main version of it. As a comparative religion student, I was interested in how religious traditions relate to each other, especially when they share the same geography, language, to some extent, the same culture. And I was surprised to see how little there was of mention of Muslims in the Chaitanya Vaishnava literature, especially these sacred biographies and the later hagiography, which are very large, talk about a lot of things, but mostly within the community. I actually read through about 13 of these. I was reading them generally to see what was there, but particularly with this question in mind, what do they say about Muslims, what do they say about Hindus? And surprised how little they said. Anyway, there seemed to be nothing, as far as I know, and some of you can help me on this, in the Sanskrit writings of the Vrindavan Goswamis. Does anybody know of any reference in all of that to the Muslims?
No, there is Andrew Nicholson, in his recent work, Uniting Hinduism. He actually argues that because it's sort of standard for Sanskrit texts to not deal with Muslim ideas. Mm. But he argues that the strong emphasis on Nastika ideas and Nastika schools and the strong rejection that you get in the second millennium, that's kind of fueled by not by Buddhist and Jain schools, which are sort of on the decline, but rather by Muslim presence. Because there's rarely sort of any ideas actually refuted. It's just the Gnosticas are condemned again and again without any attribution of ideas, and he sees sort of...
Well, in that case, this account we have of Chaitanya when he meets a Muslim makes him much more relatively ironic than the rest of the gang, because he gives the Muslim gentleman a lecture that he is indeed veering in a... not in a Gnostic direction, but in an Advaita Vedanta monist direction, and that what his text really should tell him, as it Chaitanya somehow thinks it does, is that God is one, personal, and has a dark body. I don't know where he got the last part. If you read my whole long article on... I got two articles, one on the little one on the word Hindu, and then the much longer one on the more copious things that the biographies say about the Muslims. You find that interesting little article in there. Anyway, let me wander on here and finish it up within the hour, and then we have more discussion. I was even more surprised than the relative rareness of discussion of Muslims in there. I was even more surprised at the rareness of the word Hindu, even in the copious Bengali text, Bangla text, and its total irrelevance to what they considered of transcendent devotional significance. But I was keen to learn what we could from these pre-colonial texts about whatever they would say on Hindu-Muslim relationships prior to any British invention or intensification of Hindu-Muslim communal competition. While I did not find any overt Hindu communal religio-political consciousness, I did find that there was a sense that there is a profound binary division in the population in Bengal, at least at the middle to upper levels, the Hindu versus the Yavanam Lecher, what we would call Muslim. So I surveyed all the text of the term in 13 pre-colonial Chaitanya Vaishnava text, including all the Bengali sacred biographies and the biography of Murari Gupta, but I didn't go through Kavikarnapura's two biographies, the drama and the Mahakavya, to see if the word Hindu is in there. If anybody knows, if you know, Rembert, you know more. If you find Hindu in there, let me know. I wouldn't be surprised if you don't, because it doesn't appear anywhere, as far as I know, in the Vrindavan Goswamis. But again, I may be wrong on that, but I haven't found it. Okay, so I surveyed these things and came up with some interesting things. As usual, Krishnadas Kaviraj's Chaitanya Charitamritam is the most informative of the sacred biographies, and interestingly enough, he's the only one of all of these that I looked at to mention the word, or the compound, Hindu Dharma. Hindu Dharma is a non-entity in terms of anything of religious significance to them, though it appears three times in a peculiar context in Krishnadas Kaviraj. I'll read here just the conclusion part of that essay, which I can send out to you on email if you like, and it's in the Journal of the American Oriental Society, I think, in 1973, way back. In conclusion, I wish to stress three points. First, the Chaitanya Vaishnavas of Bengal, and presumably many non-Vaishnavas as well, were aware, at least from the early 16th century onward, of two distinct categories or types of people. These were, to their minds, the more indigenous and restrained, the more refined and pure people, the Hindus, who, with but rare exceptions, included themselves the Vaishnavas. What I meant there was there were some Muslims who were actually considered Vaishnavas. And, on the other hand, the allegedly more alien and fierce, less refined and less pure people, the Yavanas or Mlechas, those that are more gracious perhaps accurate, people would refer to as Muslims. Neither category or group was thought of primarily in religious terms, at least not in the references here. though it was taken for granted that any such category of people would indeed have some kind of shared dharma, which seemed to be in the sense of religious rites, obligatory customs that are mentioned when dharma turns up. Whether either or both of the Hindu or Yavanamlecha categories included the tribal population in the region and the lowest caste or converts therefrom isn't clear from the text. The texts that we get are all by upper caste people. They talk more about upper caste, middle to upper caste persons, at least as far as any information, extended information you get. So they were aware of this binary distinction, interestingly enough, that occurs almost exclusively when there's some kind of a contact between them. If there's no contact, you ignore them. When there is contact, it is accounted for in interesting ways. Second, the Vaishnavas in Bengal did not conceive of their basic devotional commitment as bound up with solidarity with the Hindu people as such, nor did they conceive of their devotional theology and practices as a sector of or as an integral to a more general Hinduism or Hindu dharma, religion, custom, whatever that might be. Their Vaishnava faith to them was sui generis, was loving devotion, prema bhakti to Krishna, a mode of faith that in principle a non-Hindu could share. And there are several examples in the sacred biographies and hagiography of a Muslim who acknowledges his faith and devotion to Krishna Chaitanya, but says, I just can't do this publicly, and they understand the difficulty of it. Third, it would seem then that either religio-political Hindu communalism, as currently operative, is a relatively recent development in Bengal or the rest of India, or that pre-colonial Chaitanya Vaishnavas had dissociated themselves religiously from any such early version of Hindu communalism. I think the first one is much more likely. My own hypothesis, yet to be tested by research on 18th century Bengal, is that so long as the Chaitanya Vaishnavas remained the pace-setting religio-cultural exponents among Hindus in Bengal, that is, until roughly the end of the Mughal Nawab regime, their devotional from secular ethos prevailed among Hindus in Bengal well beyond their own community of devotees. But with the surge of adherence to Shakta religion by Hindu zamindars as the British East India Company began to supplant the Mughal Nawabs, the Chaitanya Vaishnava influence relatively began to wane. There was a further partial eclipse of Chaitanya Vaishnava faith, self-assurance, and influence in the course of the 19th century Bengali Renaissance, with its rationalist critique, with or without justification, of idolatry, immorality, or other alleged shortcomings of Vaishnava bhakti and the symbolism of Krishna Lila. These factors, plus the pervasive materialist ethos of 20th century modernity, have combined to undermine commitment to Chaitanya Vaishnava's traditional value orientation of loving devotion. In the process, the influence and effectiveness of their devotional way of life as an alternative to religio-political Hindu communalism has eroded, or been eroded, though not necessarily effaced. So there. So what do we find? Let's look at the sheet that is floating around here. It gives some indication of how the word Hindu has been used by our Krishna Das Kaviraj. And if we had more time, it would be interesting to go to these passages and read them. The little markings on the right, the Y's, the HN's, and whatnot, the Y means the statement, the word Hindu appears in speech that is given by a Yavana or a Muslim. An H, appropriately, is something said by the person who is considered Hindu. HN means it's a statement by the narrator, a narrator of whatever the event was, who happens to be Hindu. It's interesting that a lot of these are comments by the Muslim to the Hindu, suggesting that both of these categories are categories that you think of in terms of the outsider as an alternative to yourself. Anyway, Hindu by itself, we get four references, and you notice many of these are bunched in just a few chapters. It's only when there's a particular incident in which some Vaishnava happens to encounter some Muslim that you, in order to dutifully report what was going on, and of course see the devotional significance of that event, then you mention such things as a certain clash or cooperation in some respects between the Hindu and the So the Yavana refers to Hindu several times. Hindu K is just the accusative objective case of it. Hindu Dharma, three times the Hindu Dharma is mentioned, once by the Yavana and twice by Hindus. And I'm not recalling now whether it's in Chaitanya Charitamritam, I think it is, where Chaitanya says to the Qazi, you are responsible for maintaining law and order. Why don't you prevent Hindu Dharma, the carrying on of kirtan and such things? And then he will say that he has received a vision of the divine. I think that's in a different biography. Hindu Dharma is certainly not a category that is important to their own theology. It is something that comes up in the context of these dialogues. Yes, the Hindu Dharma of Virodha Adhikara. Yes, here that's the interesting one where he says, look, you have the authority to oppose the doing of these Hindu things. They don't have in here, oh yes, once, and then there's the word Hinduani. That's an interesting term. Hinduani, this is a Hinduist sort of things, Hindu practices, all this singing and dancing, this is Hinduani. Other texts will use that a little bit more often. We have a Hindu Ghori, that's a house of a Hindu, Devatar, a god or goddess of a Hindu, the god of the Hindus. Again, the Yavanas saying this, something. Hindu Matra, one who is any Hindu or only a Hindu would do this. Hinduani, Hindu Gan, the group of Hindus. A Hindu family, Hindu Shastra, Hindu Char. A Hindu Char would be Hindu thief, I guess. A Hindu, you have a Hindu thief, Hindu Vaishya, Hindu dress. You have various other things in other biographies where you characterize what the thing is to do. Among the sacred biographies of Chaitanya that I've scanned for the word Hindu, only the Chaitanya Charitamrita includes expressions for Hindu Dharma. And in fact, it's not even used by the later hagiographers, not even by this noted Narahari Chakravarti. Does it? It's not until you get to the Bhakta Mal, I guess, that it appears. Okay, Vaishnava perceptions of Muslims. Enough. There's a much longer article that I've done on the Vaishnava perception of Muslims that I haven't sent out, but I could. It appeared in a memorial volume for the late Aziz Ahmed, a great Muslim scholar of Islam in India. In that, you have very interesting elaboration of some of these same episodes where the word Hindu might appear, but quite a few others. And you get the case of the drunkard Muslim who, on the security officer on the border who becomes converted. You have elaborate accounts of Haridas, Thakur, and the closest that you come to a martyr in all of this literature that I've found is Haridas, and he does not die. He is beaten. There are efforts to bribe his beaters not to hit him too hard, but he's clearly severely beaten, thrown into the water, and survives, and then is treated with respect by everybody. You can go on at some length at the Vaishnava sense of fitting into a reasonably secure setup. But if you moved beyond what were the limits allowed for you as a Hindu, then you ran into some difficulty. And Haridas's problem was that he was taking Vaishnava names of God rather than doing a Muslim zikr. And the interrogator, the judge, says, why don't you just use Muslim terms? And he says something, probably in Vrindavan Das's account, because Krishnadas Kaviraj plays this one down. He tends to play down the more hostile exchanges, for whatever reason, but they were living near Fatehpur Sikri and Agra. They were under the rule of Akbar, which was a very accommodating rule. The Rajputs, who were Akbar's in the coalition, they were his allies, were given administrative authority over Vrindavan and this sort of thing. So he tends to calm it down. Anyway, let me just read this. What are the concluding observations from this longish article? Not on everything it's said in there about how what you can know of the Muslims, but what it tells about the Vaishnava's sense of the religious aspect of Muslims' lives. In sum, the stereotyped Vaishnava conception of the religious dimension of Muslims' lives is uneven in detail, skewed toward Hindu expectations, and somewhat condescending. But for all that, the stereotype is not an especially negative one, and the skewing tends to render the Islamic religion more rather than less congenial to Vaishnava Hindu sensibilities. The standard Chaitanya Vaishnava image of Muslim religious life, of which Krishna Das's presentation is the most developed example, calls for emphasizing fundamental similarities and ignoring fundamental differences. For example, the biographers treat private devotional piety as central to Islam, while they pass over in silence communal public prayers and the authority of Islamic law, Sharia. They declare that Muslims, like Vaishnavas, affirm the existence of one God who is personal and possessed of attributes. That Muslims, again like Vaishnavas, believe that salvation and bliss are to be found through devout service of God, who, though one, has many names. Thus far, in the sketch of Muslim piety, there is little to which Muslims need object. There's also a strange episode in which it is contended that the Muslim scriptures contain a level addressed to the active or pravritti life and a level addressed to the contemplative or nivritti life. And this is supposed to apply to some aspect of Muslim piety, probably to the tension between legal orthodoxy and Sufi spirituality. Nivritti, pravritti, and the applied to Muslim spirituality doesn't quite fit. It seems to reflect the imposition of Hindu categories shared by, but not specific to Vaishnavas, where the fit is not at all close. For example, the Sufi contemplative typically is not a renunciate. He typically is married, and hence the nivritti, in the sense of the celibacy generally associated with the term, doesn't apply. Quite a bit can be said about the relationship between the Hindus and the Muslims in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Again, comparing that with the others is very helpful because it some of the others, like Jayananda, bring in possible episodes that none of the others bring in part because Jayananda is a rather, takes an idiosyncratic direction anyway. One of the most interesting in there that probably didn't take place, maybe it did, has Pratapa Rudra asking Chaitanya to bless him before taking out a military campaign against Hussain Shah in Bengal. And Chaitanya is alleged to answer back in a very abrupt way. It's roughly translated, he'll eat you alive, you're out of your mind. If you want to gain some territory, go off and fight the Vijayanagar people. It's interesting. May have happened, may not. It may, however, reflect an interesting role of the Chaitanya Vaishnavas in maintaining peace between Orissa and Bengal. Keep in mind that in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's pretty clear that Rupa and Sanatan retire not just because they are inspired to follow Chaitanya or to, in one way or another, resign from Pravritti and go into Nivritti in Vrindavan, but because Hussain was preparing to have an invasion of Orissa. So they basically resign out of protest, or they resign so they're not going to be part of it, or they resign because it happens to be a coincidental thing. But it does suggest that they are in a position to have some influence on Hussain, and I just don't know the details of when they had battles between Bengal and Orissa and whether this in fact headed off one that they might otherwise have had. But there was clear, and the Vaishnavas going back and forth to visit Chaitanya in the last 18 or so years of his life in Bengal, all of which made making relationships between the two areas secure. Also their desire as devotees not to have the destruction of temples and the killing of people and whatnot, which is not a good Madhurya thing to do, and it's not a good way to treat the deities. All of this would suggest that their considerable involvement, and they did, there were a lot of Vaishnavas who were working for Hussain, considerable involvement in administration would have included a certain amount of this keeping of the peace between those regions. Anyway, this hasn't really ended in a very clear fashion, but I've kept you over the hour, and I probably should stop, so I'll stop at this point. Yeah.
There is actually a war happening at that time. At least that's what Kavi Karnapur indicates.
Okay.
I think it's when my memory is a bit vague about it, but it's at some point when a group from Bengal goes to Orissa, and I think it's when Chaitanya initially goes, where he talks about they have to take a very different route than they normally take because, and Kavi Karnapur just mentioned, because there's a war happening and so they have to find a different route to get to Orissa. So it seems there was some sort of conflict.
Well, I think there's almost always, at the border levels, India and Pakistan are still, India and Bangladesh are still, shooting at each other. Two or three people get killed a day in this thing. I suspect that there were a lot of localized ones, and there may very well have been more. There certainly were some major ones, and I just haven't had the patience to try to map from what the military historians tell us. And their stuff isn't all that helpful either, because they have to go on scant evidence. One of the reasons the Chaitanya biographies are so important, and the later hagiography, is there isn't all that much else to tell us, even the scattered things that we find here. Anything that was produced, it seems, at Gaur or Lucknowti, the Muslim capitals under the Sultanate, seems to have been destroyed. What you get of Islamic sources or Arabic, Persian sources have been, almost all have been written up in Delhi or Fatehpur Sikri, in which activities out on the province of Bengal, Suba Bengal or whatever, these things happen to get noted. But all of the local stuff has largely disappeared. There are a few letters by a Muslim Sufi urging one of the, before Chaitanya's time, urging one of the Muslim kings and up the Ganges to come down and get this Raja Ganesha, Raja Kans, off the throne, the only time between the collapse of the Hindu kingdom back around 1203 or 4, and when the British came, the only time we had a Hindu ruler. Didn't last long. His son then converted, and the son then carried on. But in the meantime, you do have this correspondence. But an extreme lack of material, all of which makes this sort of material for the ordinary secular historian of great value. One of the best studies of the Hussein Shah period is by Professor Tarafdar, long deceased, so many of these fine scholars are, on Hussein Shah in Bengal, and he draws very heavily from the Chaitanyite literature, especially Brindaban Das. Tarafdar. I think it's M-T-R, Mumtazar something or other. Tarafdar, T-A-R-A-F-D-A-R. This library is relatively weak on Bengali things. The Chaitanya Vaishnava major secondary works that we should have aren't here. The whole Oxford library has quite a few other of the older Chaitanya Vaishnava books. I know before coming, I checked to see what we had here and never really had the time or inclination to track down. They have quite a few, but it's still somewhat spotty, and there are still available published texts, not all, most of them not critical editions, but it gets you started. And using my rule of the dot matrix comic book approach, the more you can scan what is there, the more you've got a sense as to what the overall pattern is like, and then where you think you need to dig in because it looks spotty or it looks exaggerated or something.
You have a little question as a very lay person without any scholarly knowledge of this area. But there are these two climactic moments of this confrontation between Chaitanya and the Kaji.
Oh, yes.
One is when you are not allowed to take this kirtan.
Yes.
Then he's allowed.
Yeah.
The Kaji melts.
Yeah.
The other one is something to do with the pot, throwing a pot sherd. And the reply is, okay, you've thrown me this pot sherd to hurt me, but doesn't mean I won't give you love.
This sounds like the Jagai Madai attack on Nityananda. One of the two drunken Brahmin brothers was approached by Haridas and Nityananda to suggest that they take the holy names, and they responded by throwing a shard of some sort and hits Nityananda on the head and draws blood. Now, this is very important theologically because it allows several things to be affirmed in a very memorable way. And it's interesting that this is one of the things that you remember.
Well, these are two very traditional, part of Bengali culture.
They very
the
much
episode
so.
Of the pot shirt and saying that doesn't mean that I won't give you love because you've hit me.
That's a very nice way to put it. Now, when Chaitanya hears that his Nityananda has been struck like this, you have one of these rare outbursts of the Aishvarya angry aspect, which has to come now and again so that you can appreciate that the standard human leela is a leela of one who is indeed divine. So this is one of the breakout points, and he's ready to destroy this rascally fellow until his devotees point out to him, talk about Leela Maya and Joga Maya and forgetting, reminds him that you have come in this generation not to destroy demons, but to spread Madhurya and love. Love, yes. And that's, well, I will forgive him provided that my most beloved devotee forgives him. Because the Vaishnavas say that the Lord is more pained by harm to a devotee than any possible harm to himself. And he is more charmed if you have love for the devotee than if you have love for him. Nityananda lovingly forgives the chap. The fellow's brother, who was not quite as drunk as himself, tried to calm him down anyway. And the fellow's heart melts, and everybody hugs everybody as they should. And that is carried on. But it,
there's a strong parallel with this turning the other cheek.
Yes. If the devotee will turn the other cheek, then the God will forgive him.
Yeah.
But if the devotee doesn't, God help you. So it is possible for the Chaitanyites to go into a rage. And I always felt that underneath all of the Madhurya sweetness and the like, there were certain sensitivities that if you push them the wrong way, they might react very angrily, as in the way they did with poor Amulya Chandra Sen. Now, Dimmock could write his book on Bengal, and he's a foreigner, and he's got a position in Chicago. And in those days, the Hindu emigre community didn't have these vigilantes that are going around harassing scholars and embarrass the tradition, at least in their view. So Dimmock could easily get away with it. And he's a very loving sort of person. The people that he knew in Bengal and knew him were very kind and whatnot. And so he had no difficulties. But poor Amulya Chandra Sen, who was a Bengali, comes up with his book late in his career, Itihasa Sri Chaitanya, the Chaitanya of History, in which he decides to do a... it's not a spoof on them. What he does, it's a deliberately provocative, I think, critique of the pomposity of the Vaishnavites by showing from his point of view just how bizarre is Chaitanya. But he does it in a careful way by selectively quoting things that Chaitanya does and what they say about him and how they relate to him. And then he hangs this together on the framework of a looking for the Chaitanya of history. A century before, the Christians had gone into a great spasm of scholarship on looking for the Jesus of history and had very interesting results to that search. With Chaitanya, you have vastly more material to work with, and if you will, you have vastly more material that somebody with a rather critical axe to grind. I wouldn't say that. He was a very secular person. And he decided he would tell it as he saw it. And he was also a man who had worked in the, for the British under their propaganda era. So he knew propaganda. He knew Vaishnava propaganda, and he knew how to write a kind of rhetorically effective stuff as well. So he came up with this book around 1965. And as soon as the Vaishnavas saw it, they went into a rage and insisted that the government ban it. The Indian government... I don't know which government does it, the state or the federal one, but you can ban books for offending the religious feelings of a group. It's a very funny, it's not exactly blasphemy. They don't use that sort of Anglican terminology or Catholic Anglican terminology, or Islamic for that matter. It's hurting their religious feelings and devotees. So they seize the book. He, of course, objects to this and wants a court hearing. So so they set a court date. And I think the last time I met him, and it was back during my thesis days in 65 to 67, the last time I met him, I think they had set four dates at which he went to the court, and on none of those dates was the other side able to marshal a serious scholar to critique him. However, that puzzles me a bit in retrospect, because one of the most competent of the scholars, who was also a Vaishnava, and nobody to push around easily, the late Biman Bihari Majumdar, was still living. And whether he was invited to get into this thing or not, I don't know. But I know, and if you'll excuse me for passing on a slightly crude expression, he said to me about this book, there is a saying that a drop of urine spoils a bucket of milk. And I think he wrote a letter or something to poor Omoya Chunder Sen and said, I think you poured a whole cup of urine in it. In any event, as far as I managed to get two copies of the thing before it disappeared from the market.
It remained banned. Yeah? It's remained banned
all these years. He was rather saddened by it. He put a lot into that. He had done other things on the Jains. He had done some good work in other areas. I also have this in mind when I make a comment, and may or may not turn up in the lecture next week, where we're talking about the reasons for not doing academic study of religion in Indian universities, at least not as such, where I say that it's surprising, because we have had a potential conflict, as you had in Europe, a struggle between the Orthodox theologians and then those who have a more critical view of things. You have similar situations where you have not an organized church, but you have mobilizable, if you will, establishment interests of a religious sort. And I was thinking of the case of poor Amulya Chunder Sen. Would you say it's still banned? That's how many years?
It could be challenged, surely now.
Well, he's dead now. I don't know. Well, maybe we should.
Publishers should challenge him.
Tony Stewart writes in his book that he went to the publisher.
Oh yes.
And asked them he ended up talking to the persons who published the book, and they denied they ever published the book, and he had a copy of the book with him, and he said, well, here's your name on it. He said, no, we don't know this book. We've never seen it. This is not our book, and somebody else must have done this.
strange world indeed. Anyway, where does this bring us back? These texts like the Chaitanya Charitamrita, I think, have... More work is being done in the 20th century, in the late 19th century, on Bengali Vaishnava things and pushing back. You're also getting some better stuff on the Shakta side of things. Rachel McDermott, particularly, in her study of the emergence of Shakta, Shama Shangeet, and the shift from seeing Kali as a dangerous figure from whom you have very rituals to calm her anger and this sort of thing with animal sacrifice, you end up with Shama Shangeet that in tone and mood is getting fairly close to Vaishnavite piety, but kind of Vatsalya, or the other way around, from child to mother rather than mother to child. But on the one hand, the domesticating of Kali. And she has good work on certain Zamindar families' support of what was going on. And there'll probably be more of that as people choose other aspects of pushing back now from the 19th into the 18th century. There's still a lot of Vaishnava texts that, again, back to Stewart, who's done a lot of good work on this area. A lot of stuff sitting around in manuscripts that need manuscript readers. I think Tony probably does a fair amount of manuscript work himself. I don't. I tried once in Bangladesh, and I just realized I wasn't good enough at it. It would take too much of my time, and I was much happier to be a comparative religionist reading the cartoons, if you will, going down trying to...
Is it because the handwriting is difficult?
No, it isn't. It's not necessarily difficult. You just need patience. You need patience with it. Well, some of the hand, yeah, some of the handwriting is awful. But even a good person will publish an article. I know I have managed to decipher plausibly the third line of somebody's thing. But I just, having gotten into comparative religion early on, I couldn't see spending the rest of my life trying to do it. I went to Bangladesh with this wonderful idea of trying to do a critical edition of the Shruti Moina of Lord Chandrani to see if there was on the Muslim side in Bengal a treatment of a romantic love affair that would have had a Sufi type interpretation to it, the way the Krishna Lila of Radha and the Gopis has, and go back and forth. But it was too much.
Going back to the first topic that you raised regarding the historicity of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, I was just wondering to what extent you thought your observations regarding how Chaitanyites view the historicity of Chaitanya Lila can be applied to their understanding of the historicity of Krishna Lila in the Bhagavad Puran.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Because, there's been a tendency almost to sort of do a Dimmock-like reading of how Chaitanyas understand Krishna Lila. You know, it's the sort of rasa of the Lila that's important, the amrit of the Lila, as opposed to the actual events themselves.
I think the Vaishnavas would say that insofar as Krishna, who is, in the last analysis, everything, and the gopis and Radha are shaktis of him, and to that extent it's all one, insofar as he chooses to do a lila, a dramatic manifestation, then the shape and form of that dramatic manifestation is important. It was important enough for Krishna to do it precisely that way, and it's certainly appropriate for us to try to follow how he did it. Now we ought to understand what it means, and number one is it doesn't mean that it's a warrant for marital infidelity. Though nowadays, in a more freewheeling society, one might say that these poor girls that are married before puberty to these dull husbands who take them for granted, it seems only appropriate that if Chai Krishna is only about 13 or 14 himself, why not maybe go out and have some fun? But that's not their approach. They would feel that to focus their own meditations properly, the details of the lila are very important. Paintings that you have coming out of the ISKCON tradition do this visually. The lila kirtan performances, where you dance and sing, in some way dramatize and considerably elaborate in detail, but trying to help you to visualize, even with the sound and the like, of what it would be like to be dancing with Krishna. I think this, they say, that for the sake of eliciting and giving proper rusic shape to your devotion, that the details are important. But it's not a physical kind of thing. It has no exemplary modeling, as Chaitanya's life, most of it is seen as a exemplary model. Krishna chose to come in this Kali Yuga as Chaitanya to be the appropriate devotee. Krishna did not appear as Krishna in the Vraj Lila as the devotee. He appeared as himself. The devotees were the gopis, and indeed the associates of Chaitanya were, in a spiritual sense, mostly considered gopis, though some were considered gopas, especially in the Nityananda tradition. Which allows me to put in one further thing on the Sahajiyar case. One of the things I found most annoying in the identification of alleged Sahajiyars is finding Janava Devi as the childless younger wife of Nityananda as a Sahajiyar. I don't think there's any evidence of her being that, except that there's some people further down the road in the tradition that traces, accurately or otherwise, traces their pedigree back to her or a disciple of her. And she was a very central figure, and I think from what I've read was a key, and it's not stressed, I don't think, in Tony's book, but that she had a role in proposing that Srinivas, Narottam, and Shamananda actually go to Vrindavan, get trained, and come back. The treatment that I've seen in Tony, though I haven't read every page of the book, puts the emphasis on the people in Vrindavan deciding to send these folks back, and it comes as a terrible surprise, and they're heartbroken that they have to leave Vrindavan. But prior to and leading up to their coming back with the books and then having these big Mahotsavas in which people are given copies of, should not be the Chaitanya Charitamritam, that doesn't come until 1615, but of the Goswami's books, I think she had a major role in keeping that network of disciples somewhat together and sending them off. But anyway, that's an aside that shouldn't be there. Yeah, go ahead.
I want to actually go back to your previous question about the use of Sahaja term in a pejorative sense.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you to what degree actually the whole Gaudiya tradition from the writings of Goswamis was actually trying to ward off against this over emotionalism and suspicious use of suspicious practices that were there at even at the time. I mean, I read something about in that book a lot from Day on Vaishnavism. History of Vaishnavism.
Early history of Vaishnavism.
Yes.
Vaishnav movement.
Where he actually talks about that these things were present and the writings of Goswamis were actually in some ways not a reaction, but a way to kind of a distance the tradition from these suspicious practices. Would you agree with that? I mean, so somewhere there.
First answer is we don't know what their intention was, except that there are some late accounts that Jiva Goswami, the second generation, more philosophical, more systematizing figure of his seniors, is alleged to have been unhappy with the idea of Krishnadas Kaviraj sending off a Bengali language version of their teachings. Tony goes into quite a bit of detail in discussing the hems and haws of that one and how the accounts of this dispute differ, this strange account of throwing the manuscript into the river and it floats around for some time and finally miraculously comes back and changes Jiva's mind on it. It's kind of hard to... That sort of thing is a bit hard for the historian to figure out. It certainly indicates that at a time after the Chaitanya Charitamrita has been written and has come, that there is dispute going on whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. The fact that they stay in Vrindavan and write in Sanskrit certainly minimizes the likelihood that Sajjayas or anybody else would do it. It's unlikely that they would not expect that at some point and in some way the tradition would find their work would find its way back. But it is a bit puzzling that it took them so long to do it, and it wasn't until Srinivas and company went there and themselves were well trained and came back that it would happen. They probably were aware that the perennial rustic tantra, left tantra of Bengal was around. But it would seem that their main reason for being there is to establish the holy places as visiting spots for pilgrims and to do the theology that was needed and to practice their personal budget. S.K. Day, anything he says that's sort of based on good textual stuff is very reliable, and his book is extremely helpful for accurately summarizing many of the main texts. I think he minimizes the significance of Chaitanya as being recognized as Krishna. It's obvious that their Goswamis are writing about Krishna, but it's not obvious that they did not consider Chaitanya to, in fact, have been Krishna. But like Chaitanya, they wanted to put the focus on the Krishna that he was so agonizingly devoted to, so they were not so agonizingly, but very religiously committed to doing themselves. They may have been aware of it in the background, but I don't think it's a major factor. I don't know.
We have to stop a minute. I was going to ask one question, actually. Was Krishna Das Kaviraj, he's presumably writing his text for the Gaudiya community. He doesn't want to convince anybody else about the divinity of Chaitanya.
I don't know. I would think that he certainly is writing it for the community. There's no doubt of that. But the fact that it's then available to a community that had up until that time been expanding and perhaps...
There's a conversion dimension to it.
There's a conversion dimension here. The Chaitanya in his earlier devotional years, when he has this remarkable conversion at the age of about 21 or 22, and then it's spreading the word, singing the names of Krishna to everybody, men, women, shudras, sinners, even animals if they can hear it. I think he would be aware of that this would facilitate not only pulling this community together. Tony Stewart is very concerned, and I think quite rightly, to show that Krishna Das wants to bring together the several shakhas or branches. Branches of a tree tend to keep going out that way. And now and again, you either prune them and cut them off and say they're all heretics, or you try to find a way of pulling them together in a more Catholic understanding of things, and that seems to be his role. But it's still a tree that we like to think is still growing, or I would like to think that he thought would still be growing. At the beginning of each chapter, he says he salutes Chaitanya, Nityananda, and the Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. This is Gaura in the sense of Gauranga. It's the devotees of Chaitanya. So he salutes them at the beginning of this. So that's pretty clearly what his main audience is. But Gaura, the Chaitanya devotee community that he's saluting, is a community that till then and now sees itself as having a universal message. It seemed to me often enough that one of the other main reasons, back to your question of the what the Goswamis thought they were doing up there in Vrindavan, by writing in Sanskrit, they were preparing for a potential dissemination of the teaching throughout the Sanskrit-using world. While the Chaitanya Charitamritam is very helpful in sending the message back to the east, to Bengal, the main thrust of the Goswami's work was in Sanskrit, and the Sanskrit would most likely, they would like to think, be read throughout India, and perhaps over a long time scale. After all, these divine appearances in the world don't come all that often. The Kali Yuga has got a ways to go before everything gets burned up and whatnot. So they may not have been any, they clearly weren't in any great rush. And I think that they would like to have seen the spread of the doctrines throughout the significant world. If they knew about North America and the British Isles, they probably would have figured eventually. Now with all these diligent Sanskritists here, but
He makes a comment in the introduction to his book when he's commenting on A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami's commentary, saying it's a very proselytizing agenda there, not unlike the original book itself.
Good. Thank you. Even this book itself.
Yes.
Wonderful. Because you have episodes in there in which, if not Chaitanya, others go around. You have the chap who's so happy that he figures that the Muslim got converted in this funny way. The Muslims, oh my God, haram. This haram supposedly means impure or something. The devotee is delighted. Ram, he's taken the name of Ram. Ram's the name of Krishna. <you say? laughs>
That's a miracle story.
It's extraordinary how you have this range, if you will, sort of like having a gigantic sitar with very high notes and very low notes, and all of the ones in between. Who's a Vaishnava? Oh, he says the name of the Lord once.
There are some good Muslim Vaishnava poets.
Charakaji. There's at least one book edited by a Muslim scholar in Gathering News. There's another one edited by a Hindu scholar. That's true. And this is one of the points that I make in other context on the contribution to Bengali cultural integration from the Vaishnavas. The Muslims at a communal level, leave aside political communalism, but there was this unfortunate, perhaps, but this this perception, at least on the Vaishnava, on the Vaishnava side, of a binary division between Hindus, whoever the rest of us are, and Muslims, whoever the rest of those fellows are. But the singing can be heard by anybody. And if the Shaktas become softened somewhat, thanks to Vaishnava Kirtan, and we end up with Shama Kirtan that Rachel has done so much work on. And interestingly there, one of the finer poets that she has in her second volume, which is the anthology, is none other than Qazi Nazrul Islam. I just saw an email on the internet. I somehow stumbled onto this. Somebody put me on. I don't know why. It's fascinating. I get a lot of messages from different Bangladeshis overseas back home, and some Hindus. And some of the messages are very awful, and some are very intelligent and interesting. And just recently, someone is recommending an article, not for a book, showing how Qazi Nazrul Islam is such a wonderful Muslim poet because of the various Islamic themes that he develops, which he does. But he also develops all sorts of Hindu themes and all sorts of humanistic themes, and is very critical of the first thing of his that I ever translated, Mundir or Masjid, somewhere between a short story and an essay, in which he denounces the fanatics of burning down one another's temples and mosques and the like, and ignoring this poverty-stricken woman with a famished child. Very powerful stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he also had his softer moments, and he loved the Vaishnava theme.
Well, thanks, Joe. Thanks very much indeed for sharing your work with us. I look forward to reading more of it when we get.